Want a chance to win £250 in vouchers? All you have to do is fill out the Ballpark's listener survey. It takes just 15 minutes. The Ballpark podcast is celebrating our 10th anniversary in 2026. And after more than 130 episodes covering U.S. politics, we want to hear from you to shape our next decade. So hit the link in the show notes for the survey details and prize draw terms and conditions. Share your thoughts, and you could be £250 better off.
Hello, and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan U.S. Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, managing editor of the Phelan U.S. Center's blog on U.S. politics and policy, USAP. The last decade has seen a period of prolonged competition between the U.S. and China, with China continuing to grow economically and to pursue technological self-reliance, while the U.S. attempts to hinder this growth through measures like export controls. My guest for this episode of The Ballpark is Dr. Uzier, senior research fellow on China at Chatham House. She argues that this relationship has led to a sense of besiegement by leaders in Beijing, as the United States seeks to prevent China from becoming a global power. Our conversation looks at how this concern about U.S. encirclement has impacted U.S.-China relations, including China's efforts to diversify its trading partners and supply chains, and its focus on domestic economic resilience. We also discuss what China has learned from the U.S. about how to act as a global power, and its willingness to become one or not. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I hope you do too. So thanks so much for joining us on The Ballpark today. Just to start things off, could you briefly introduce yourself and what you're working on currently? Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. I'm much delighted to return to LSE, as I consider myself as my own intellectual home since I graduated from here and taught here for several years. And I'm currently a senior research fellow on China for Chatham House, a think tank at the Royal Institute of International Affairs based in London. And currently, I'm working on a whole range of issues related to China's foreign affairs and also on China's economic diplomacy. But most recently, I've took over this Horizon Europe project by looking to China in a non-monolithic way, by observing China not just as a one political entity, but many different players that interact with each other and determine the policy outcomes, both for its domestic political economy, but also for its foreign affairs.
Thank you so much. So how has China viewed America in recent decades? And how has that changed under the Trump administrations?
Very interesting question. I mean, in the past few decades, let's start with back from 1979, when the two countries established a formal diplomatic relations. I think in the matter of that 10 years, between 1979 and 1989, and United States see China as a sense of de facto ally, and that is willing to help China to become a modern economy, and perhaps also even more liberal country, as you may call it. But I think what has happened back to 1989 has changed United States' assessment regarding China. But also it comes to the moment that China, by introducing economic reform by itself and let its own economy took it off across Asia. So one of the pertinent questions is whether to allow China to join WTO or not. And obviously, United States and many other European countries allowed China to do so, and hence China become a full member of the World Trade Organization from 2001, and hence really established what we call it the modern day framework of US-China relations where we have today. Now, I think really in the early of the 21st century, according to Bob Zolek, the term they've used been considered China as being a sense of responsible stakeholder. That is to say, the early image of the framework of the so-called G2, that United States and China can co-manage the international issues and the international affairs. But obviously, things got changed so quickly that the view of United States towards China has changed quite dramatically. I think equally China, given its rise of economic might, the rise of military heft, and also the rise of the technology advancement that Beijing is intended to make. So I think really started from 2012, from the late Obama administration. They have introduced the so-called Pivot to Asia initiative introduced by Hillary Clinton. And then obviously Beijing take this with a great sensitivity and unease and consider that perhaps United States began to change its view towards China, and also domestically President Xi Jinping came to power around the similar time. And then obviously his view towards United States, I would say, has not really changed that much ever since he came to power back to 12 years ago. And that is to say, he strongly believed that United States and China entered a period of protracted competition I use the term protracted competition is because it's an analogy of how China dealt with Japan back to the 1930s in the time of the Pacific War. But I think Xi Jinping also viewed that on this relationship with the United States. That is to say, the United States will never really be happy to letting China become the number one or supersede the United States in order to acquire that sense of global superpower status. Hence, because of the leadership have such a strong conviction regarding this protracted competition between Beijing and Washington, and hence many of the policies, many of the policy responses, what we have seen today, for example, export control, for example, on China's pursuit of technology self-reliance, all derived from the so-called protracted conflict between China and the United States. So I think let's just use the term protracted conflicts between the two.
So your seminar today at the Phelan US Center frames China's mindset as being under siege from the US and its policies. Could you elaborate on why this perception exists in Beijing and what consequences has this had on US-China relations?
Well, obviously, this term, we're adding a little bit of theatrical significance in here. It all comes back from the comments that President Xi made back to March 2023 during time of National People's Congress. And he referred a sentence by saying that so openly, the US-led West had never ceased to contend China. And that is so clear. And it really laid bare in terms of like US's ambition. That is to say, do not allow China to become another superpower that coexist with United States peacefully. So I think because that particular sentence and that conviction President Xi had, and hence you had a feeling of that Beijing felt the sense of besiegement, the sense that is to say, because of US's technology advancement, because of US's economic significance, but also because of US's pursuit of self-power around within China's neighborhood and make China feel deeply sense of being encircled by the United States. I think that sense of besiegement and undersiege, and that is a very strong feeling. However, I believe that feeling, it is also shared by many among the permanent members of the Chinese strategy community. So that seems to be a consensus in here for now.
So has this sort of siege mentality also impacted US-China trade relations?
Precisely. I think what the first Trump administration has taught China a very pertinent lesson, that is to say, one cannot having the entire supply chain, whether it's on agriculture and whether it's on economy and whether it's on technology in the hands of your adversaries. And what happened on the first round of the trade war between China and the United States is that China began to gradually diversify its supply chain on agriculture, on food, on energy away from the United States. So we start with the whole supply chain discussion back then. And then as time passing by in the last 7 years or so and so forth, we have seen that China's diversification strategy seems to work very well. And when they come to this round of the trade war, we had discussed back to April in 2025. So in a way, China is really prepared the worst yet to come on this geopolitical headwind regarding United States. I think I give the example on the agriculture, on food security, but I think that become even more pertinent when it comes to the high-end technology manufacturing. On the one hand, China is intended to become the global manufacturing champion. But I think on the other hand, China also learned very pertinent lesson during the Biden administration because of the very stringent export control towards a high-end semiconductor, towards high-end aircraft machinery. And that left China without much choice apart from producing its own. So hence you've seen a great stride of the pursuit of technological self-reliance. And that is also derived from what happened with United States. I think in a way, what United States found what China was trying to do in the last 7 or 8 years is actually a mirror image of what United States have done back to 1940 and 1950. So in a way, the character of the great powers become quite contagious and they learn from each other. So it's really United States serve as a mirror reflecting on China today.
So thinking about President Donald Trump's use of tariffs, both as a foreign policy tool and a kind of a bargaining chip, really, how has that impacted China's perception of the US as an economic rival or potentially maybe in the past a partner?
Well, I think very little. As I said earlier, there's a sense of diversification have already been in full display in the past 12 months. And also China diversified its important trading partners away from the so-called collective West. So far that China trade more with Southeast Asia, countries added all together than compared with Europe and the United States added together. So in a way, I think the tariff, yes, it sent a shockwave along different manufacturers within China. But fundamentally, this has not really touched the nuts and bolts of the Chinese economy. That is to say, the export market of China has already been diversified away, not concentrated on the United States, but instead focusing on the non-Western countries in here. So tariff or non-tariff, I think Beijing take this as a way, firstly, to manage Donald Trump, because President Trump, particularly under his second term, see his competition with China purely and simply in economic terms, not in a holistic approach of strategic competition. And I think secondly, by using tariff also as a tool for the policymakers in Beijing to unify the country, and that is to say, to serve a sense of national pride that Beijing can say no to the United States, which actually won enormous amount of chairs among the ordinary population.
So in a September 2024 article that you wrote for Project Syndicate called How China is Preparing for America's Next President, you argued that Chinese policymakers have adopted a whole country approach to dealing with the US. Can you talk about what this looks like in practice and what benefits and consequences has that had on wider regional or international relations?
Interestingly, that whole of nation approach term, it is not referred by the Chinese policymaker. It's actually a term referred by the former FBI director Christopher Wray by saying that China has used whole of nation approach to compete with the United States. Now, by introducing the whole of nation approach, that is to say, China as being one party state is able to assemble the enormous amount of resources in its own hand and allocate it to the sector of the strategic importance. So I give example of a semiconductor. And we all know that China is still lag behind of United States regarding the semiconductor and particularly the most high-end one, for example, the Blackwell 200 made by NVIDIA. So China's strategy in here is that if I'm going to develop my own supply chains on semiconductor, and hence that would require me to spend enormous amount of money on this. Now, if you go back to China's public national budget last year, we have seen that every single item, whether it's on education or social welfare, is increased according to this inflation rate. However, with the exception of research and development, has increased 12.3% beyond inflation. And in a way, Beijing has invested so heavily on this technology self-reliance in order to compete and in order to, in a way, to protect itself against the US as export control. So that is to say, the government is able to allocate those resources for its own need. Now, secondly, whole of nation approach. I think by devising the industrial policy, by devising a technology policy, it's not just the policy itself, but it's also a public narrative and a public expectation management, because the Chinese public views towards the United States has turned extremely sour, has turned extremely negatively. So in a way, Beijing and the Chinese policymakers cannot afford to look very soft in front of Donald Trump particularly. So what Beijing has done in the past 12 months seems to generate sufficient public support over there. So again, that is a whole of nation approach with you. So you have the resources and you have to make sure the public opinion is on your side. And also lastly, but also in a very technical sense, that China does not have an independent central bank, unlike the Fed, where the Fed chair do not necessarily need to listen to US president, whether it's Trump or Biden, but the Chinese governor of the central bank need to listen to what Xi Jinping says. So in a way, the central bank will have to prepare for the different valuations of US dollars against the RMB as well at the same time. So in a way, it's a well-orchestrated institutionalized approach in preparation in competing with the United States.
So in another piece for Project Syndicate last year, What China Wants, you argued that Chinese leadership has no interest in filling America's shoes and that sooner or later it will have to develop a truly global foreign policy. Why does China have no interest in going down America's path? And what would that global foreign policy look like?
I think there's something quite puzzled me recently, given what we have now, the crisis in the Middle East, given this ongoing war in Ukraine has been raged on. China's responses, despite all the disruptions being brought by the Trump administration for now, China's responses on both crises seems to be extremely timid. Now, let's to start with what China want. I think first priority for the Chinese leadership is the regime security. Now, the regime security largely would be constituted through the social contract, that is to say, provide a reasonable standard of living for its own population, but also to create a level of prosperity that make people feel is more acceptable. So that's the priority number one for the Chinese government and also for the ruling Communist Party. And that would require, at the current moment, when Beijing has experienced an inflection point of transforming its economy from largely led by infrastructure and property and transfer itself into an economy derived by technology development, derived by high-end manufacturing. So that would actually require sufficient financial resources to return at home in order to pursue that sense of economic resilience that Beijing wanted. So once you decide that limited resources to stay at home, and hence that determine Beijing will have to spend less when they come to run a global diplomacy agenda. For example, if we have seen the Belt and Road Initiative in the past decade or so, it cost trillions of renminbi. And then what was the consequences of the Belt and Road Initiative? I think it's a mix of success and failure added all together. Now, whether Beijing still has the similar economic capability of running something similar, and that is questionable. So I think really, if Beijing wants to build its own domestic economic resilience, the priority and also the financial resources need to stay at home. That's one thing China wants. So in no rush of filling the void left by United States. Now, secondly in here, I think the most important thing is also Beijing observe how United States behave by being a global power. By being a global power, you are willing to engage with conflicts in the region that you hardly know. And you're willing to be a global security manager in the regions that you know very little about. And I think these are the two criteria Beijing have to fulfill. But I think Beijing is far from being willing to do so and far from being capable to do so as well. So that's the reason I would say the priority will remain at home for Beijing.
A question for you. Have you filled out the ballpark survey yet? It's just 15 minutes, helps us get ready for our 10th anniversary, and if you're lucky, you might win £250 in vouchers.
In your December 2025 foreign policy article, Three Lessons China Learned from the US, you argued that Beijing learned the template for global power from Washington's example. Could you talk about how that template has been adapted to suit China's goals, both domestic and international, and how likely is it to succeed in achieving those aims?
Well, there's a quite layered question in here. Obviously, I think one line which I put it up is the greatest export of United States towards China. It is not democracy. It is not political system, but it's the template how to be a great power and how to be a superpower. And obviously for China, it took three things in here. And the first thing, as I explained quite lengthily earlier, regarding this pursuit of economic resilience, the sense of self-sufficiency. Now, secondly, I think really throughout the last few years or so, Beijing has also learned that being dependent towards the others, and also, you know, have a sense of interdependency. In the golden age of globalization, it is a bonus. But in the age of the world that enter into multipolar and also the sense of global disruption, being interdependent is a sign of weaknesses. And hence, once you have the weaknesses in the hands of your adversary, and that means the superpower A would have the power control over the superpower B and vice versa. And that is exactly what the United States has to do with China during the Biden administration, and even started from the Obama administration regarding the export control on high-end technologies, regarding the export control on monetary terms, and regarding using US dollar as a monetary weapon at the same time. So that sense of the interdependence would be a cause of collateral damage for countries' economy. And hence Beijing has decided to know that superpower is become powerful, not only because it know when to open the door, but also the superpower know most importantly when to shut its door regarding to the other superpower. So that's the second lesson. Now, I think the third lesson in here for me is most interesting. That is to say, China has not only picked up the successful element of United States by being a superpower, but China equally picked up what the United States failed to do so. Failed to join into the conflict that is unnecessary. Failed to join into the conflicts that United States only halfly understand what is actually engaged with. Look around what happened after the news of this week and what is next for Iran were very unclear. So in case of China, because it shared the borders with 14 different countries, and that would require Beijing to have some kind of reasonable relationship with its neighborhood, the energy to focus on its own immediate neighborhood, but not energy to spare somewhere afar, as what the United States has been extended from Africa to Latin America and into Middle East and so on and so forth. So give another counterexample in here that United States and China does not necessarily have any fundamental conflicts in the Middle East. Partially is because China enjoyed the global security architecture that been provided by United States. And China is able to take in the monetary and commercial benefit from that. But is China really willing to establish own global security architecture? I think we're quite far away from that. So I think that's the three lessons Beijing has learned from United States, how to become its own global power.
Then following on from your comments about China's neighbors, you've written that China's strategic orientation is not global, but regional. How is China developing its relationships and partnerships with neighboring countries? I'm thinking really specifically Russia and India.
Well, you picked two very interesting ones. That is to say, these are the two biggest nuclear neighbors that China shared a border with. Now, let's start with Russia. We often remember that how close that China-Russia has been for now, but we seem to forget how fall apart that Beijing and Moscow in the past has been. That is to say, when the time of the Soviet Union, Beijing and Moscow had a quite decisive split against each other because the Soviet Union invited China to become a part of the military alliances, something that China has always refused to sign up for. And hence the consequences is that Soviet Union withdrawn all the technological support towards China back to 1950s and 1960s. That also teach China a lesson, is to say, I may not necessarily share the same value as you, but it does not prevent me to work together with you on a common aim. So in case of China and Russia, I think that's how precisely been described it. That is to say, China does not necessarily agree with Russia in terms of worldview by being a disruptive force of international affairs. But what bound these two countries together is firstly because of its resentment towards US hegemony across the world. And I think secondly, because of the geography, because the two countries that share the borders of 4,300 kilometers, which is equivalent the width of Europe as a continent. And that determined how China will have to work together with Russia on a range of security issues. So that's China and Russia. But obviously, because of Russia's invasion towards Ukraine, and that has made the European policymakers examining China-Russia relations in a greater scrutiny. And I think this won't change, and it will continue to do so until the war towards Ukraine comes to the end. So that won't change. Now, the second pair of relationship in here, it seems to be also not running without difficulties. The two countries, by being neighbor, they had a border clash back from 1962, and in the recent one is 2020. Now, I think both countries consider themselves as being a civilization state and proud of their history and the past. And both countries also somehow taking the so-called non-aligned foreign policy in the heart when it comes to foreign policy agenda. However, the trouble is for China, it always viewed India through the lenses as being a proxy of the United States within the region. And whereas I believe for India, they always considered themselves in the game of competing with China in terms of both regional influence, but also global influence as well. So that largely determined the two countries cannot getting very close with each other. But nevertheless, I think it's because of the geopolitical reality of Asia, but also the geopolitical reality of what happened and the dramatic change happened at White House and has actually persuaded China and India become some kind of reset its diplomatic relationship from the end of 2024, I think really reached the climax by the Indian Prime Minister Modi attend the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit last year in Tianjin. However, the existing irritants of the border clashes and border dispute has not gone away. And there's also a hanging question of the future of the Dalai Lama, the Tibetan government in exile residing in India, and who will be the next Dalai Lama. And that would also provoke certain controversies within China as well. And I think lastly, it's also to do with the public opinion and the nationalistic foreign policy both Beijing and New Delhi has run. That is to say, both Beijing and New Delhi, and using nationalism as a very much key strand of its foreign policy. And they would really turn up the volumes as they wish. And then that largely determined the two countries' relationship will progress further, but with plenty of hindrance and irritants over there.
Well, that's pretty much all we have time for this afternoon. But before we do finish, I'd just like to give you the opportunity to direct our listeners' attention to any recent or upcoming books, articles, or other projects you're working on that you think they might find to be of interest.
Sure, I'd be more than glad to introduce my current project, which is looking into China's relationship with Europe and how this has evolved, really, from the Russia's invasion towards Ukraine. And also, what I'm trying to do now is I'm doing this backcasting activity by assuming an existing scenario of China-Europe by 2036. And how did we actually arrive at that point where Europe perhaps more dependent on China than many of us would imagine? So that is something I'm working on in the pipeline. So keep all your eyes on it.
Our listeners should definitely keep a lookout for that in the near future. Just remains for me to say, Dr. Uzier, thank you so much for speaking to the Ballpark today.
Thank you, Chris.
Dr. Uzier is Senior Research Fellow on China with Chatham House. And that's it for this episode of the Ballpark. Thanks to Dr. Uzier for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan US Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. On X and Instagram, we're at LSE_US, and on LinkedIn, we're LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Avan Fata. Our theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and like lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. You can email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at LSE_US and tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast don't reflect those of the Phelan US Center or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.